Founded in 1991 by patients, the FSHD Society is the largest grassroots network of FSHD patients, their families, and research activists. The FSHD Society offers a community of support, news, and information for the millions of people affected by FSHD worldwide. This is FSHD Society Radio. Welcome, one and all, to the FSHD Society Radio Show. Hope you're hearing me loud and clear as we bring in yet another episode, oh yes, of the FSHD Society Radio Show. So glad to be here with you, and so excited to see how things play out today as we have a great guest coming up, Dr. Anthony Romeo. He has done the webinar for the FSHD Society, for the FSHD University. I believe on the 20th was the day that he did that. And for those that attended the event, I watched it back. Very interesting comments. We want to hear from you a little bit if you've had the surgery or thought about the surgery. This is going to be your time to ask Dr. Romeo those questions. In about 8 minutes, he'll be live on the FSHD Society Radio Show to kind of follow up on the webinar a little bit. He'll give a little bit of his background, a little bit of the surgery, the details. I have some questions based off of what I watched on the webinar as well, but love to hear from you and what you have to give. So feel free to chime in with some comments. I'm hoping to be able to follow along with your comments as well, and type in as I'm doing right now. I try to multitask. And what we're going to do is definitely field your questions. That is going to be the point, right, today, is that I want to make sure that if there's questions you have about this surgery, for me, I have my own opinions. I think I'm going to hold those maybe for the end, till after Dr. Romeo comes on for sure. But I think it's going to be a good show and a good follow-up to the webinar, which is kind of what we've decided, we being the FSHD Society, June Kinoshita, Lee Reynolds, and myself, that have really helped kind of put together a weekly schedule for these shows, you know, to kind of give it to you one more time is, you know, a featured guest, a unique featured guest will be on the first show of the month, and the second will be about the mental side or emotional side of FSHD. The third will be the physical side, which we had last week with Bill and Mitch, and other physical therapists that have to do with FSHD will join as well, as well as the mental side. It won't just be Jen Eggert who is going to join us in those shows. It could be other guests, but we're all going to kind of focus in on that subject matter. And then on this last one, when we have a webinar in the month, we are inviting that guest to follow up their webinar and come on this show. So it's another great opportunity for you to talk about that subject, maybe get your questions heard on a different platform or find out more information. If we happen to have extra shows during the month, obviously we'll have that then for, or maybe not obviously, we'll have that for you, right? The call in, ask me questions, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot in store as we keep going forward from week to week with the live web radio shows, and I'm always excited to bring them to you. I love talking to this community. It's great to bring it all together. Another great thing I wanted to plug that is coming up is the walk and roll September 12th. So if you're not aware of it and you want to know about it, go to fshdsociety.org. I think everyone by now that's listening to this is pretty aware that we're going virtual with this walk and roll. And we're going to broadcast an event with it, kind of carry it with it. So I'll be there bringing on some great walk leaders, walk and roll leaders, as well as others that I think are going to contribute a little bit of their perception of the walk and maybe where they're walking and get them on. So that's going to be fun. I think that's just, you know, going to be a blast. And Max Adler, the actor, producer, is going to join. And I think they have like a competition going on where you can have an hour with Max in this broadcast. So like Right in the middle is going to be an hour where you can kind of spend some time asking Max questions. Maybe it's about his past work, upcoming work coming on, his work with the FSHD Society. So I think that's being kind of given away, that time, based on some type of donation dollars. So more to come maybe as we approach that day and look for that. I know Max Adler is definitely taking a lot of time to help spread the news about the walk and roll on his virtual platforms, which, you know, he has a large following. We really appreciate the fact that he's doing that. He's really pushing hard to get the word out. He's being an exceptional ambassador in that regard, and we thank him. So if he's listening or hears the playback, thank you very much, Max Adler, for doing that. Follow him on social media platforms, you know, if it's Facebook or Instagram, Twitter, whatnot. I know I follow him on Twitter, and I know I see he's posting a lot of things about the virtual walk and roll. So it's exciting to have that kind of push behind us. Next week's show, if we look at the calendar coming ahead for the FSHD Society Radio, is the featured guest episode. And we're going to have two guests. We're going to have Lee Reynolds and we're going to have Beth Johnston talking about the virtual walk and roll. So it's going to be great to have them come on. Maybe you're going to have questions. Maybe you say, oh, how do I participate? Or can I come on and show where I'm walking? Or how do I comment? Or if you have questions, it might be a great time to ask them. They might be answered for you as you listen to those featured guests talk a little bit about, you know, what's going on. So let's open up the comments here. I want to make sure I see if we get any comments. Yeah, here we go. Oh, wow. Okay. Oh, yeah, Lee Reynolds is already typing in here. She said, hey, Tim, hey, how's it going? It's all possible because one guy stepped up to create, lead, and facilitate these awesome radio shows. Oh, Lee, stop it. No, it takes a team. It takes a team, definitely. Sorry, I'm catching up on the comments. Sue Drescher's here. So I'm trying to follow the comments along. For whatever reason, it doesn't come up on my live feed in front of me. I have to kind of join the show, as they say. And comment in along with your comments. So sorry if I'm a little delayed, but I'm there. I'm here. So in about 3 minutes, we're going to bring in our featured guest. After that, of course, obviously, you know, I'm going to see the comments, see what's going on, see what people are saying. Here we go. Yep. And we got Sue in. I'm going to give you a lot of hearts and all that kind of stuff as I go along on my tablet. I'm following along. So it's always fun to do like three screens at one time. Multitasker. Dr. Anthony Romeo. I want to say Romero. I'm going to have to correct that very quickly. Romeo is coming on next. So let's take a quick break. And we will get ourselves ready to talk to him because I know I want to know about the scapular winging and the surgery where he does the fusion. We'll talk a little bit about that, his response he got from the webinar that he did back on the 20th, which we were very gracious for his time. I know he's a busy man and he's extending his time a little more, right, to be here with us as well. So it's going to be exciting. All right, so let's take a break. We come back, we'll bring in our featured guest. You're listening to the FSHD Society Radio Show.
Hi, my name is Allison Calder, and I have been the Utah Chapter Director and Walk and Roll Leader since January of 2019.
Hi, my name is Amy Beckier. I'm an FSHD Society board member for about, I think, 8 years now, and a chapter director in San Diego for 3.
Hi there, my name is Ann Babcock, and I am the Colorado Walk and Roll Coordinator, and I have been since January of this year.
My name is Amanda Hill, and I am the director of the Colorado chapter of the FSHD Society.
I'm Heloise Hoffman, and I'm Southwest Florida chapter director since August of 2019.
Hey guys, Jack Gerblich here. I'm the Atlanta Chapter Director. I started the chapter back in 2018.
My name is Kathy Sonico. I've been a Chapter Director since 2017.
Hi, I'm Mark Christman, Director of the Western Pennsylvania Chapter.
Hi, my name is Minette Hale, and I am the Idaho Chapter Director and Idaho Walk and Roll Leader as of this year, January 2020.
Hi, I'm Rachel Sarton, and I'm excited to be a brand new chapter director here in Central Texas.
Hi everyone, my name is Taylor Quigg and I am a 2020 Walk and Roll coordinator with the FSHD Society.
These are some of the voices of our leaders, chapter directors, and walk and roll leaders. If you want to join the army of these advocates, visit fshdsociety.org. Because together, we can do this. Welcome all back to the FSHD Society Radio Show. Thanks for spending the Wednesday evening with us. We have on the line, very excited to announce our featured guest for this show, is Dr. Anthony Romeo, and he did a fantastic webinar for us, and he's extending even more of his precious time with us here on this radio show, so we welcome him in now. Hello, doctor. How are you?
Hi, Tim. Thank you very much for the opportunity this evening.
Oh, no doubt. This has been phenomenal that you were able to come back and join us a little bit on this different kind of platform. And I did watch the webinar, the playback. I'm guilty. I could not watch it live, but I did watch the playback of it and got educated and about what the surgery is about, at least on the surface level. I've heard about the scapulous fusion surgery, I suppose, is the best way maybe to say it, or stabilization surgery. And I've heard about it from other patients that went through it or thought about it and didn't know, you know, if that was something that I'd be a candidate for or even something I'd even want to do. So the fact that you took the time to kind of break it down in that webinar was great. And I know it really affected or made a positive impact on a lot of people and helping kind of clear their minds. But for those that missed it or had an opportunity to ask you questions, I'm really glad that we could bring you in today as well. So where I'd love to start, though, is a little bit about, you know, I guess just a touch in on your background. I know currently, is it DuPage? Is that how it is pronounced in Illinois? That's where you're working out of. And your expertise is in orthopedic surgery. So just tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about the background, so people kind of build up in case they don't know.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. I'm going to go back just a little bit. Sure. Where did I find this interest in scapular instability? Yeah. I did a fellowship at the University of Washington in Seattle, and my mentor out there took care of patients with these very unusual scapular instability problems. And they could happen from neurologic problems. They can happen for muscular dystrophy problems. There can sometimes be traumatic reasons. And so I actually saw one of these procedures when I was a fellow, and I was very intrigued about how it was done and really remarkable to see the patient 6 months later and how much it had changed their ability to use their arm. And basically the bottom line with the surgery is that the scapula is the foundation for the shoulder. And so when you go to raise up your arm, if your body can't hold the scapula against your chest wall of your rib cage, then it pokes out the back. And if it does that, you can't raise your arm above the level of your shoulder. In fact, it goes down a little bit lower than that. And the example I use is that if you're standing on the ground and you go to pick something up, you have nice stability of your legs and your core, you can lift very heavy. And then you take that exact same person, you put them on a skateboard, and you ask them to lift something up. The amount of weight they can lift is dramatically reduced because they don't have the same stability. And that's what happens with the arm. So the muscles of the deltoid and some of the others are good, but the ones that hold the scapula against the chest wall are not. And so the arm not only doesn't have the motion, it doesn't have the strength to do some of the functions. So then when I went to Chicago, I joined a group at Rush University, and there was a gentleman who's relatively famous among the FSHD community. His name is Irwin Siegel, because he and Wilton Bunch were two orthopedic surgeons at Loyola that wrote one of the early papers in the United States about scapular fusions for this problem. And the results were good. It was a small series. And it just so happened he had moved over to Rush. He had given up his surgical practice for the most part and was working in the neurology department. and I presented a case of scapulothoracic instability. And he was in the meeting, and he then just explained all these things he'd been doing with the FSHD Society. We did a couple of cases together, and he said, well, you've got this, and so I'm going to send you my patients. And so over the years, I do three or four a year, and so now it's into the past 100 of these cases. And it's been a really a wonderful experience in caring for people that have a real challenge and have actually a reasonable solution. It's not an operation for everybody, but for those people that are really challenged by the inability to put their hand in space where they need to, this can make a difference in the quality of their life.
So it actually helps within strength and stability, you're saying, doing this procedure?
It does. So with the scapula stable, you then have the movement of your hand through ranges of motion that you couldn't comfortably do before. And in addition, because it's stable, the muscles that are not affected by FSHD, like the deltoid muscle, the pectoralis muscle, and others, can move the arm and stabilize the arm and apply power to the arm because it has a stable base to work from when the scapula is fused to the chest wall. So you gain not only functional range of motion, but also the ability to use your arm with strength at a better level.
If I was considering this, I mean, what kind of things should I be thinking about in considering this kind of procedure? You know, is it where my range of motion is just unbearable, where I can't do much function at all? Is there, you know, is there, like, what kind of, like, it's hard for me to ask. Like, for me, if I was going to go off of, I guess, my own personal body and how I feel, I know I have a hard time not necessarily reading or reaching the first shelf in a kitchen cabinet, but definitely the second, definitely the third, right? So I can get my elbow and my shoulder probably level, you know, in my reach. But beyond that, it is a struggle unless I assist it. So it's someone like me, I'd imagine it's not going to get better. It's just going to get worse. So in that range of motion, in front of this little camera, I know that some are watching just me here, but I am raising my arm. So if I was like I described it, my elbow is about at the same level as my shoulder when I raise my arm. So is that kind of, would I be a good candidate, or should I kind of start strengthening or try to on my own first and then consider surgical?
Well, your last statement I'll address first, and that is we always recommend that you give your best effort at trying to strengthen the muscles around the shoulder girdle to see how much you can do without requiring surgery. So that's always the first recommendation. Mm-hmm. Many of the people that come to me have already been treated for 3 months, 6 months, or longer, and say, not only am I not better, but I feel like I'm gradually getting worse. So that's one thing, is there's this perception that I'm losing more of my ability to raise my arm. The second thing that I think is really important is that it is an individual decision. Mm-hmm. This is not a life-threatening deformity. It's something that you have to have done. You can live with the scapular instability, but obviously there are some compromises. So what I try to do is, when people are sort of sitting on the fence or not really sure, I try to explain to them what the surgery does, but I also, if we're face to face, and obviously this is without some of the guidelines with COVID, but even now I would do this with a mask on and be safe. But I actually come up to the patient and I hold their scapula against their chest wall with my hand on the front of their chest. It's a pretty strong hold. And I say, go ahead and raise your arm. And I show them what scapular stability provides to them and let them decide, is that really significantly different than what I've had before? Wow. And sometimes some will say, you know, it's not bad. Other times I do that and it's almost like their face lights up and goes, oh my gosh, if I could do that like that, that would be awesome. That would really change a lot of things. So I think there's a bit of an individual decision. Mm-hmm. And as we know with FSHD, it's the way it actually presents objectively is quite variable. And so, you know, some people have a little bit of the problem. Some people are very severely affected by it. So I try my best to put it in the perspective of the patient, try to share with them what we've seen with other patients, but also what their specific change would be that would be valuable for them. And then I definitely go over a couple of things that are important to understand. When we do this, there is no going back. You can't undo this. So it's a very important life decision. Number two, there are some motions that are actually going to be restricted from normal motion. And so we see, especially a lot of our younger teenagers, early 20s, where they've learned to kind of almost throw the arm up and then balance it at a higher position. It doesn't have much strength, but they like the fact they can get their arm more in a straight up position. When we fuse the scapula, it can't get out of the way, and you're going to lose some of that straight up and down, like reaching to the ceiling motion. It's going to be about 30 to 40 degrees less than that. And some people are nervous about that. The difference is that motion, especially from shoulder level up another 30, 40 degrees, is going to be done with power. So you're going to have more function than you did before through that range of motion, even though you lose a little bit of range of motion. And you also lose the motion, which is not that important in everyday life, but you lose the motion if you put your hand in a handshake position and rotate out. That also is reduced, again, because you can't get your scapula out of the way. And so there are some activities and things where that might bother you. For the most part, the personal care, eating, bathing, and those kind of things, no issues there. But I want to make sure that they know there is a little bit you have to give up to get the stability of the scapula in terms of motion to gain that strength and positioning of the hand.
Now, I have a couple of questions come through as you were talking about that, and they might be relevant a little bit to the area of the conversation we're in here. One is, says, hi, is complete rotary muscle tear in the shoulder, is it advisable to get surgery? So I don't know if they're speaking upon the surgery we're talking about, if they're getting that specific, or just get surgery on that tear. So I'm kind of asking the question on behalf of this person, but I think, you know, maybe they're saying if I have a rotary muscle tear in the shoulder, is it still advisable to get maybe this surgery that we're talking about?
So I agree with you. That question needs just a little bit of a follow-up question, but let's try to answer it as best as we can. So the vast majority of people having the surgery are under the age of 35. And so rotator cuff tears are extremely rare in that age group, unless there's been some kind of traumatic event. But I would say that the value of the surgery is to diminish the effect of the instability of the scapula. And that is the muscle that it does that, that stabilizes. It's called the serratus anterior. So muscles that are not the serratus anterior, each one of those that are affected are going to diminish the ability of that operation to give you the full benefit of that operation. Mm-hmm. So if you do have a tear in your rotator cuff and you have a scapular thoracic fusion, it will stabilize your scapula, but you have a compromise of the shoulder at a different area that won't be resolved by the stabilization of the scapula. Just like if you had another muscle injury around the shoulder, if your deltoid muscle was injured or your pectoralis major muscle was injured, the scapular stabilization surgery is really effectively neutralizing the fact that the serratus anterior muscle doesn't work. I'm sorry for all the medical terms, but that it's important that we separate these out. And so just in terms of location, the serratus is the muscle that is close to the spine that holds the scapula against your chest wall. If the rotator cuff, which is it's a tendon that goes over the top of the humeral bone, and it has four parts to it, and those four muscles start from the scapula. So when you fuse the scapula, you've stabilized the base of the rotator cuff. But if the tendon that goes to the humerus is not attached, then it's not going to make a difference in terms of that rotator cuff, and so you will have some deficiency. I will say if you have FSHD and you have an injury and you have a rotator cuff tear and it is painful, then it is reasonable to have the surgery for that rotator cuff repair, although the results of that are not as good as the general population. The alleviation of pain and the maintenance of a better function is the right thing to go. It's just a very rare situation to happen.
Yeah. Another one for you, and you answered that phenomenally, because I know it. Yeah, definitely had this kind of needed maybe a little more information for us, but I think you answered that very well. The next question we have is, can someone with severe dystrophy in the biceps and triceps, can they still qualify for this surgery?
That's a very, very good question with tremendous insight. And the answer is maybe.
Okay.
Because the biceps and the triceps manage the elbow, not the shoulder. So if you have a scapulothoracic fusion, so the scapula is now, and the chest wall are now one piece, you have stabilized the scapula. That will allow you to move your arm bone, the humerus bone, in ways that will position your hand in better spots for you to be able to do things, like you mentioned, at the second shelf level or something like that.
Right.
However, if you lose control of your elbow, you then have a deficit beyond the fusion, which will affect your result. And I have had patients who have had a significant involvement there. And I had one person in particular who had the surgery because they were so frustrated with their scapula. And I can tell you that the result was inferior to what both he and I had hoped for, because not because of the scapular stabilization, but because his control of his elbow was not very good after surgery. He thought that might improve, but really it didn't. And so he was happy the scapular surgery went well, but disappointed at the amount of change in the use of his arm that he got. So I do think it's something you have to have a very careful conversation. And if it's pretty severe, it probably in most individuals would knock them out of the picture, because it does affect, again, the ability to position the hand, which is what we're trying to do.
You're listening to the FSHD Society Radio Show. We're talking with Anthony Romeo and Dr. Anthony Romeo, and he's talking to us about an orthopedic surgeon is his profession, and we're talking about scapular fusion or stability surgery. He did the phenomenal webinar on the 20th for the FSHD Society, and this is kind of a follow-up to that. So thank you all for watching and participating on Facebook Live, and thank you so far for those questions. And please ask more. We will definitely direct them over to Dr. Romeo. So pain level. I know that some people probably are asking about that, right? What is the pain level after surgery? We all deal with pain on a regular basis and soreness and this and that, but what can they expect if they decide to go with the surgery? What kind of pain level are we looking at? And then how long maybe in recovery?
So the pain after the surgery is significant, which means it has to be carefully managed. It's not something where some people can just kind of get by and they'll do okay, and other people need a little bit of medicine. Mm-hmm. Everyone needs a little bit of medicine. This is a very uncomfortable surgery. And the reason why is because we are affecting the normal parts of your rib cage, the muscles around your rib cage, and some of the normal muscle on the undersurface of the scapula. Because what we have to do is I have to get the muscle out of the way so that the bone of the scapula can touch the bone of the ribs. And normally there's some flesh around those areas, and you have to clear that out of there. So we remove some muscle. It actually has to, some of it has to be removed to create the space. We have to work around the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth ribs, which is uncomfortable. If anyone's ever cracked a rib when they've had pneumonia or had someone accidentally hit themselves there and you have a cracked rib, it's hard to breathe. It's uncomfortable. Well, they have four of them that hurt. And so that it does get hard to breathe. And early on in my practice, I realized that that probably wasn't doing as good a job as I would have liked to manage that pain. And what I learned is a couple of things. If you're very delicate with the surgery and you go through the planes that you're supposed to go through, then that's one thing. You minimize the amount of injury to the normal tissues. So I think that's very important. The second thing is that we have to have a really strong method to stabilize the scapula against the ribs. The ribs are kind of flexible, and so we need something. And so we developed, or I developed a plate with wires that kind of helped hold it down like a vice grip. And we've gotten to the point now we have a special synthetic tape that's even stronger than the wires, but the safe that holds it very, very steady. And I think having that rigidity of fixation. The third thing is, which is a minor point that turns out to be a really critical one, is at the end of the fixation and we're getting ready to close the incision, I take local anesthetic that's going to last for 6 to 8 hours and inject it at each of the ribs where the nerve is right below it. And the purpose of that is so that the person having the surgery can reestablish their breathing. The way the lungs work, if you don't understand that, is that the lungs actually expand or open up, and that negative pressure opens up the lung tissue like the bellows, and that's how air comes in, and then it closes back down. Mm. If you can't open up your lungs because it's so painful, you're not going to take a deep breath, and the sacs that make up the lung will close off and can get infected. They can cause fever and other things. So we really want people to reestablish their breathing within the first 4 to 6 hours after surgery. And if we do that, then we'll deal with the pain, and we do use narcotic or opioid medication. And I would say the average patient needs to take it fairly regularly for the first 48 hours and then starts to taper off. And the vast majority are off the medicine within 5 to 7 days or only taking it at night to sleep. And pretty much everyone's off of it within 10 to 14 days. We have a rare patient once in a while for other problems, maybe back problem, that was taking the medication before surgery, and then it takes them a lot longer to get off the strong medication. So I think the last thing is that we do put patients in a brace that holds the arm pretty steady. So I think each of those steps has helped to reduce. And, you know, in the early days when I first saw this done in Seattle, the patients were spending 5 or 6 days in the hospital. And now, generally speaking, if we did the surgery on a Monday, they're leaving the hospital by Thursday, occasionally by Wednesday, but usually by Thursday to be able to go home. So I think we've done a good job of understanding how uncomfortable this can be. And that's one last thing. Sorry about that. We take the bone from the patient's iliac crest, and that's the prominence of the hip in behind close to the spine. It's not actually the hip joint. It's the bone that's there. And that too is an uncomfortable surgery. And so we're very careful. There's a way to do this where we actually, instead of just cracking the bone, we have a way to almost like open it up and then take the bone out from inside it and then close it back down, which helps to minimize the discomfort. But that's sometimes the hardest part for the patient is not the breathing, but the next day to get up and walk. Mm-hmm. And even though the hip joint is stable and the back is stable, it's just the muscles around that area are so uncomfortable. We have the physical therapist kind of help them get used to walking again. And that usually takes a day or so. So that's a great question. I'm not going to try to fake anyone out and say, yeah, Oh no, this is easy. It's very uncomfortable. We do everything we can to manage that, to create as little pain as possible, but we do have to use some strong medicines for at least a few days.
Nice. How about, you mentioned physical therapy, like immediately after, it sounds like, for stability in the walking and work through the soreness. How about any long-term physical therapy after, like maybe when they're going home, should they be seeing a physical therapist after this procedure for a certain amount of time? Do you recommend that?
So the most important part of this, of course, is getting the bone to fuse to the bone. In the early days, 30, 40 years ago, we didn't have some of the sophisticated braces we do now. And so the treatment was, we did the surgery and we put patients in what's called a spica cast. So their arm, their forearm and elbow was in a cast. Mm-hmm. And then we literally used a broomstick to hold the arm out about 6 inches and then put a cast around their waist to hold this arm in this rigid position. And it was thought, because of the fixation, everything, that it would take up to 3 months. And as anyone who has this condition knows, if you immobilize your muscles for 3 months, it really does a number on them in terms of how much weakness they develop and how they thin out. So immobility is not our friend. And what we've done is we've been able to reduce that down to some of our young teenagers to no more than 4 weeks. But for most patients, the guideline I have is 6 weeks that we have to hold them in a brace, but it's not 3 months. And we do it for 6 weeks. And then I have them see the physical therapist to work on gentle range of motion. And we start strengthening somewhere between 10 and 12 weeks and advance them along. Most of the patients are doing pretty well by 3 months, but don't have a lot of strength. But somewhere between 4.5 and 6 months, it really comes along nicely. And then I always think that, boy, that's really great. And then if you see them back at 1 year, you'll see that they've kind of fine-tuned how their whole body works, and they've gotten even better than they were at 6 months. But I think the 3 month outcome is enough for the vast majority of patients to say this was worth it. Then 6 months, they get a little excited about some of the things they can do, and if they keep doing their exercises and strengthening their shoulder and arms and stuff, they oftentimes can get even a little bit better by 1 year.
How about with lung capacity or lung use? I know some people that have FSHD have shortness of breath. Does this help? Does this procedure help in that?
No, it doesn't. In fact, if anything, it can make it a problem. So I have all patients go through pulmonary function tests where it looks at the capacity to bring air into your lungs. And then whenever you do that, there's always a little bit left over. So we call that the residual air capacity. And when you fuse the scapula to four ribs, you reduce the ability for that lung to open up like a bellow. So you do reduce the vital capacity of the lung for a short period of time. And that's why it's, there are examples where some patients have had both sides done at the same time, which is really, really tough to recover from because it's hard to breathe. You have to have chest tubes in because you have to move the lungs out of the way. I don't use a chest tube. You don't need one if you do one side at a time. And they really have a hard time getting their breathing pattern back to something close to normal for about 3 months. I've had a couple of cases where a patient had the surgery done and was doing pretty well around 6 weeks, and then really driven mostly by insurance issues. So it's the end of the year. So they had one done in September, and it's getting close to the end of the year. Their deductibles, and they encouraged me to go ahead and do the second one. And both times I've done it, I've been sort of disappointed because I can see how hard it is for these young people to breathe for a while after the second surgery. They do get it back, and it's not life-threatening. Yeah. It's just challenging for them, and they feel like they can't catch their breath, and they feel like, but it does gradually come back. So if someone has a problem with their ability to breathe before surgery, that can be a contraindication for having the surgery.
We had another question on Facebook Live here. What other treatments do you recommend if surgery would not be an option for this?
So there's really not been one home run type of treatment. We've all heard about some of the medications that have been tried and yeah, a variety of different things. And I don't know if there's any strong evidence that any specific medication or variety of different treatments has any sustainable long-term value. Some of them have a short burst of value, but then they kind of wear off and are not very effective. So I think we'll all be happy when they come up with some of the genetic treatments that'll be available to slow the progress of the condition and do that. In terms of other non-surgical treatment, it really is challenging because we can strengthen the muscles around the shoulder. But the serratus anterior, it's such a, it's like such a direct hit to the foundation of the shoulder because of the ability to hold the scap against the chest wall. There really isn't anything else that substitutes for that muscle that we can do with non-surgical treatment. In the past, some people have actually tried to do tendon, which is not non-surgical. Some people have tried techniques that don't fuse the scapula. So they've moved muscles, or they've done techniques where they put the scapula and the ribs together with a softer fixation, so a rubbery fixation to give it a temporary. And all of those techniques gradually stretch out over a relatively short period of time. And so it's frustrating, but the treatment is physical therapy, mm-hmm. try to do things around the arm to help you position your arm better, despite the fact that you can't have really great control of your scapula. That's really the underlying principle.
How about the response then from the patients that have gone through it and have come out the other side, right? They went through the pain, managing that, getting themselves to a more healthy state, right? Where they can look back and go, okay, yeah, this is great, and this is why. What were some of those responses that you received from the patients that are received a positive experience?
Yeah, so part of the confirmation of the positivity of the experience is that about 3/4 of the patients that have bilateral scapular instability will end up having their second side done at some time in the future. So in other words, they've had one done and the other side, they could get by with it, but they have been happy enough with the outcome that they went ahead and have the other one done. So that's one of the confirmations that if I can't put it in their words, I can share with you their actions that suggest that this was valuable for them because it was painful, it was a long recovery, and yet they came back for the second one. Mm-hmm. In terms of the actual words that they use, some of them are almost emotionally triggering. So when I had a young 30-something year old mother who came to me who said that my child, when she was smaller, it wasn't so bad, but now that she's 2 years old, I can't even really pick her up and everything, and I'm wondering. And by the time we had fused both shoulders within 1 year and she could come back and pick up her daughter to hold her to her face and kiss her, I don't know if you can put a price on those things. It's just what is important to certain people. And, you know, I know it's a moment in time, but it's just sort of a reflection of how some people really value things that we don't always think about. Mm-hmm. I think people really appreciate the fact that they can wash their hair without a kind of a funny pattern of throwing their arms up. I think people, even if it's not perfectly cosmetic, I think they appreciate having their shoulders in a better position so their clothes sit on their shoulders and don't drop or droop off of their shoulders, and they can't wear some of the clothes that they like to wear. I think people like to be able to put things up into a shelf or lift a book up to shoulder level or above and do some of these activities. And I think they feel like they blend into the normal physiology and muscle use that they see of people around them. And mm-hmm. I think this is particularly true for our younger kids. They get a little bit self-conscious about it. And so it's helpful for them to feel like they blend in. As an adult or as a parent, we, of course, would never be concerned about that for our kids. But our kids sit, a lot of social pressure, and I think they really Absolutely. Appreciate the fact that it makes them feel like they blend in a little bit better. And so these are all subtle things, and I wouldn't say that these are indications for surgery, but I really – it's hard to quantify the look and the feel in many of these young people's faces when I ask that question, do you think this was helpful for you? And the response is usually very, very strongly positive. And then they share what's important to them that they can now do much better that they couldn't do before.
We have one more question I wanted to give you before we let you go, doctor. And this is because I guess this is sure. kind of very poignant to what you've been talking about here in the last minute. It says, my 14-year-old daughter's scapula has started to wing. We are discussing surgery now. Should we wait until she is older? She has very painful growing pains. Should I wait until the growing is over? So it sounds like a concerned parent.
So there is some concerns and controversy over whether when they're below the level of full maturity, whether the surgery should be done. And so I think one of the things is that the age is one of the factors. And then if the young lady is actually, she's 14, but looks like she's going on 18. So she's gone through her growth spurt. She's got some of her adult characteristics. We treat them as they're ready to go. I think The youngest person that I've done, and I will admit it, is 12 years old, and it was a big controversy. I asked some of my colleagues over in Paris, France, where they've had a very large neurological center and musculodystrophy center in Paris, and they said, well, we try to wait, but occasionally we have to do younger patients. And I had a very long discussion. Obviously, at 12, it has to be with their parents. Well, her mother had bilateral scapulothoracic fusions and felt that it was really valuable to her. And she did not, and her daughter was already unable to raise her arms with power up to the level of her shoulder. And she thought that based on her own personal experience that she shared with her daughter, that this would make her transition through her adolescence and young adulthood much better. So that was a family decision in that regard. And I'm sure some could argue one way or the other, but that was the youngest patient. But from a medical perspective, if I look at the young lady or young man somewhere around the age of 14 to 16, which is a little bit of that where we get nervous about it, if they've kind of reached that maturity, what I don't have to worry about, what some people say is that, well, if you do that, you're going to fuse the ribs and they may go on to have spine problems, and we've never seen anything like that. So I think some of these theoretical things that people talk about are probably really just being overly conservative. I think that when you do this operation, the rest of the body adapts and manages it. And I've not had a problem in our teenagers doing this. So if this young lady that we're discussing specifically is 14 years old, she's a mature 14 years old, and this is affecting her daily life and, you know, and in some degree, her social status, her mental health status and other things, and having the ability to have the use of her arm and stabilize her shoulder in a better position would be valuable for her. I don't think that age is a criteria that should contraindicate the surgery.
Awesome. Thank you, doctor, for answering that question. It sounded like it needed to be asked and answered, because I think there is probably a lot of parents listening to this or could be in the future, you know, when this episode is posted, that might want to, you know, tackle that question in their own home. So hopefully that information has kind of shed some light for them. If people listening want to go ahead. You have more to add?
I was going to say, you know, I've been doing this now for more than 25 years, and I've gotten to know a lot of things. It's kind of sad to see how many of these young people are treated for depression because they're not smiling. And they're not depressed. They have to figure that out. It's sad to see how their activity levels are restricted because people are worried that, if you do something, you hurt something, that's going to make a big difference. It's been sad to see that because it's a muscular dystrophy that some physicians have lumped this together with the other two common muscular dystrophies, Becker's and Duchenne's, which has a very high risk of complication with anesthesia known as malignant hyperthermia. This condition doesn't have that. And I've had people where the most important part of their visit with me was not the discussion of scapulothoracic surgery, but the fact that I could tell them that, no, your risk is the same as the normal population. And if you need to have a surgery, whether it's on your abdomen or some other place, and you've been told you can't because of this risk, well, you need to find another doctor and another anesthesiologist, because there's no increased risk over the normal population. So I really think that it's important to have these educational events so that we treat people based on the evidence that's out there and we do the best thing for them. And again, I think for our younger patients, I think it's a family decision, and we always have to focus on what's best for the child. And sometimes is scapulothoracic fusion the right answer? I would say many times it's wait a little bit, let them mature a little bit more so they can handle not only the surgery, but the postoperative recovery and what's going to be necessary to get the best result.
Awesome. Where can people find more out about either this surgery or even yourself, doctor?
Well, honestly, I think you know the answer to the first question, and that is the FSHD Society has been an incredible resource. I mean, this wasn't available in the past, you know, so it's the Society has done such an incredible job of providing so much information and guidance, and I think that's really, really been wonderful. So I would start there, and the officers and leadership there can guide many people to the information that they want. But I'm not putting a plug in because I'm on the show. It really is the first thing I ask patients, have you signed up or gone on for the FSHD Society? And I'm surprised how many know they have the condition, so, and they say, no, I didn't know. So it's not that you have a public relations problem. We just have to get the word out to everybody right. because it's such a valuable resource. And it Thank really you. Is, even for physicians. Hmm. The second part of your question in terms of my practice, and I didn't finish the whole story because it's not the purpose of tonight, but I did mm-hmm. take a little bit of a break and went to New York to try to put together a program there. It wasn't really what I expected. And so I'm back in Chicago and okay. I'm rebuilding my practice. And so it's very easy to find me if you go online. My website is www.anthonyromeomd.com. So you just put in anthonyromeomd, all one word, .com. And you'll see my website and it'll be very easy to contact me or reach out with a question, or if you'd like to come in for a visit. And we are going to, you know, I mean, with the, you know, the pandemic, mm-hmm. we've all learned some new things, and, you know, we are offering the possibility of a, you know, a telemedicine visit, if that would be better. Sometimes I think I have to say, you know, I really have to examine it, but there are many times where we may be able to answer some of the key questions through a telemedicine visit. So if that's helpful for you, then just go online to the website, contact us, and we'll make sure we can get that set up for you.
Thank you very much, Doctor, for joining us today and doing the webinar and all you've done here for the FSHD Society to help get the word out, not only about our group and our community, but sharing this message and this option for people and educating us today. We really appreciate your time.
Again, thank you so much for the opportunity. And it's been a real honor, pleasure, and I'm really humbled by the society, the things that you're all doing, and the people that have this condition and go on to live an incredibly normal life and very productive. So it's been a real honor to be part of all that.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you again, Doctor. Take care.
Okay. Have a great night. Bye-bye.
So that's Dr. Romeo helping us out, educating us about what this surgery is about. We've had some great comments, great questions. Kudos to the listeners. This community is sharp. Definitely. Awesome questions. And I hope we got as many as we could out. I'm sorry, Michael, he asked, you know, is 50 too old? I would definitely say, you know, reach out to anthonyromeomd.com and ask. My from what I saw or listened to today and on the webinar, I would say it's not, but he would say probably set up a televisit. So that's probably the best way. You had somebody say that they had their surgery in 2003. It helped for all these years, and said thank you to this Dr. Anthony Romeo. We had so many other people make comments. You know, what a great explanation of the surgery. Our daughter has had the fusion surgery on both shoulders a little over a year apart. Dr. Smith performed it in Seattle, and it was phenomenal. And she appreciated this interview and having Dr. Romeo on to talk a little bit about this consideration for others. And of course, I mean, we want to give you, you know, your platform to get all the data you need to listen to things that might help you if there's something you're looking for or an answer you're seeking. But I must say, the thing that scares me on this, and I don't want to have my opinion deter people or, you know, say they don't, you know, that they shouldn't do it because Tim said so. I don't think I have that kind of weight, for one. But my personal thing is, because this definitely affects my shoulders. I'm 45 years old. It affects my shoulders. I have a hard time lifting. I get the winging. I mean, that was really where my problems came from. I don't have issues with facial muscle weakness right now. Leg weakness definitely is getting worse and worse and worse. And that seems to be the roller coaster ride right now, downward. But my shoulders, I mean, even just how I posture myself during the show when you see me sitting at this desk and how I move, I mean, you can see it. You can see the winging in the set. I might be a good candidate for this. But what scares me, as I was going to say, is it's permanent. It's permanent. So that's tough for me. I don't know. I don't know if I'd want. It would be something I definitely would have to think about. and keep talking to my community if it was something I even would consider, and those that have gone through it and what's been their positive to it. And it's only fixing one area of my body, yet my legs are still going to be weak as all get out. So, you know, I help one thing that I'm sure would help. And then, of course, the surgery and trying to recover from that and how that makes your muscles weaker, just trying to recover and heal from that kind of scares me a little bit. So I'd have to educate myself before I would make a final decision. I hope this kind of helped with you all that are listening, that if you were thinking about it, maybe this was something that, you know, would help in your decision. So we thank Dr. Anthony Romeo for being on the show today and helping us answer our questions. And also all the time he gave during the webinar was awesome. The other thing is, too, is that I do want you to look up his website, anthonyromeomd.com. He seems very open and a great communicator for those of us here in the FSHD Society and our community. So if you have questions, I feel he is going to be absolutely a positive place to go. And I don't think he's slanting our decision one way or the other. You know, he said it multiple times. It has to be your decision, something you want to consider if you'd want to, you know, fuse that, go through that surgery. Like I said, for me, it is very difficult to do something permanent. You know, the disease is definitely affecting my shoulders, definitely affecting with the winging. I feel like it's kind of plateaued, but in things I do and the struggles I go through, man, would it make the difference so I could coach baseball easier? Would it make a better difference so I could manage through my daily living things? I think right now I'm just compensating, and that seems to be enough for me. But now when I'm in a state of looking for income, and I used to do physical work, if I had a surgery like this, would that help in that so I could stay working and do the physical work I used to do? So that to me is also something that makes me, you know, it's like I'm playing this way in one side and way in the other, and then blah, 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 balance back and forth. Make your pros and cons list, right? Educate yourself. That's what I guess is my theme here, and I hope that this helped. Before we bid farewell for this evening, I love the fact we get such great guests on. I love the fact that we have awesome community that participates in this show each week. We try to give you some great guests, give you your platform. This is what it's about. It's not about me. It's about we. It's about really, no, you know what? It's about you. And I really want this to be a show that this community can rely on. Next week, we have great featured guests lined up for you as we talk about the big virtual walk and roll coming up September 12th. We're going to have Lee Reynolds and Beth Johnston on to talk about that. I hope they remember. If they don't, they're probably watching it now going, oh yeah, that's right. So we're going to have question and answer time with them. That's going to be a lot of fun. I'm very much looking forward to that as we get prepared for the huge walk and roll virtual event on the 12th of September. That's a Saturday, folks. So stay tuned. More information to come. The Connecticut Connections. I always have to slow my pronunciation down with that one. On September 3rd, they're meeting 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. It's 8:30. So you can visit that virtually. That sounds like fun. I've been a part of those meetings way back. I got to revisit that group. Of course, as we talked about, the walk and roll event coming on September 12th. I can't plug that enough. And then we have another webinar scheduled for the 17th of September. So a lot of things going on in September here in the FSHD Society. You can email me anytime, even after the show, if you want to ask me something or just want someone to talk to. I'm here for you there as well, not just during the show. You can email me to start the conversation at fshdradio@fshdsociety.org. Love to hear from you. If there's guests you want to have on the show, maybe you want to be that guest. I'd love to hear from you on that as well. Visit fshdsociety.org and also our guest website, anthonyromeomd.com. Until next week, I bid you all health and enjoy the week. We'll see you here same time next week on the FSHD Society Radio Show. Take care. Good night.